Welcome to the Recovery Stories Podcast, bringing you stories of hope, healing, and triumph over the bondage of addictions, mental health struggles, trauma, and dysfunctional family systems. Our courageous storytellers have chosen to live their journey out loud in order to show others that they don't have to suffer in silence. The stories you will hear are raw, real, and may involve graphic and triggering content. This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted Alumni Community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or are ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
Welcome to this episode of Rooted Recovery Stories. My name is Patrick Custer and I'm your host. I could not be more excited to introduce to you our guest today. He is a dear friend of mine and wow, what a story he has got to share with you all. I've had the honor of getting to walk this journey with him a couple times, and I'm looking forward to hearing it again because, like many of our stories, it involves a lot of heartache, tragedy, but even better than that, it involves solution, triumph, and hope, and overcoming. So I can't wait to dive right in. Brian Sullivan, Sully, thank you so much for being here. And I'm so glad we're finally getting to do this episode together.
Patrick, I love you so much and I love this show. And I just hope that I can live up to some of that introduction. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Well, I know that you will. You know, I think one of the things that I've learned to embrace in my life, and I try to enforce and encourage on this show, is how important and how special it is, with all of our blemishes and all of our just appreciating and valuing all of our stuff just the way it is, you know. I think that's something that you do so well. So let's dive right in. Okay. I mean, there's so much to your story and I want to try and get to it all. And you know, start from the beginning of where, you know, the parents that you were born in, the family life you were born into, and what life looked like then for you as a baby.
So most of my friends know me as, you know, a recovery mental health advocate. And that is because really I have been surrounded by mental health issues, recovery issues my entire life. I've had people in my life who have struggled with that. My parents were musicians. My dad was with a group called the King Beats. It's in the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. My mom was a blues singer. The whole time that she was pregnant with me, she was singing in New Orleans. And my parents sort of, you know, there was this sort of chaotic life of musicians that I just was thrust into, because they always had a gig. You know, there was always somewhere to be on the weekend, and you know, they were very, very talented. You know, unfortunately, my dad didn't see a lot of the return, you know, monetarily, but they were well respected musicians. They actually kind of grew up together and knew each other, and then they kind of got close. My mom was guested on a record that they did called Bad Bad Boy, and my brother was born. They were married, and then years and years later, I came along.
Yeah.
And my parents were a little bit older by standards then they were older, you know, 33 and 30. That was old.
Like the
60s and 70s. But, you know, I came along late 70s and my parents were separated at the time. And, you know, I sort of they sort of got back together for the kids, which if you're listening, you should never do. You know, you should think about the kids, but don't make the kids your decision for staying together, because it can actually be harmful to them. But yeah. I had a loving home. Some of my earliest memories are, you know, sitting under the piano, listening to my mom play. I would cry and cry and cry. And when my mom would play the piano, it would soothe me. And I was able to, you know, sort of mellow out. So there were constantly people in and out of our house rehearsing, you know, doing sorts of things. It was, you know, like any musicians, there was, you know, the temptation for alcoholism, and drugs. And, you know, my father, was addicted to alcohol. I don't want people to think that I had bad parents or that I grew up in a bad home, but there was a lot of anxiety. And, you know, my brother knows this, and I've talked about my brother. I actually called my brother before doing this interview, because we've talked about it extensively. You know, sort of the environment that we grew up in. You know, my dad, had a temper. He could be irrational. There was a lot of anxiety in my home, and there was also a lot of love. So I feel like my parents did the very best that they could with what they had.
Yeah.
That can, you know, still to this day, you know, it can affect you. There's always that kind of nervous, feeling that at any moment somebody's going to change and flip and fly off the handle on you, you know?
Right. Yeah. That, I think that a lot of that can resound for a lot of us, that have either dealt with anger issues in the home and, or, you know, addiction with a parent or a primary caregiver, that it's something that kind of never really leaves you.
And for sure, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, I was fearful of my parents, you know, when they would fight or whatever. And, you know, I thought that that was normal. I thought that, you know, dads came in and parents broke dishes, and that was just like a normal everyday thing that everybody went through. And I didn't realize until I started kind of going over to other kids' houses, oh, like there's like kind of a calm and a peace. And my mother was very protective. You know, she was very, I felt completely safe with my mother. My father and I made amends later in life, and we were, actually became close. We became best friends. But my mom was my anchor. Like she was my best friend. And I knew, like, whatever happened, if they were arguing or whatever, she was there. I was okay. I was going to be okay.
Yeah. 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 Well, speaking of mama being your anchor, about this time in your life, you know, there was a shift in, and maybe I'm getting the timeline wrong, when you changed schools. Is that about right when we're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, there was, when I changed schools, I grew up in Memphis, my parents, you know, played music all the time when it was time to go to high school, I was on, my whole life up until high school, I was on scholarship for a private school. I made straight A's. I was Dean's List. And, you know, never had a problem with my studies. That was never an issue for me until, you know, we moved to North Mississippi, and I, you know, wasn't able to get into a high school that had a scholarship program, and my parents really couldn't afford to send me, you know, to a private school. So I switched to public school. So there was a lot of transition there because we're moving to a different state, but it's close, but it's a different state, different, you know, policies, whatever. I moved to a different school. I'm learning things about my sexuality. And my mom is falling into a deep depression because she has lost her father. So if I could go back, if I were doing a timeline and put like little blue dots of points in my life where it started to take turns, that would be one of them.
So you talk about, you know, starting to identify things about your sexuality, you know, when we, and I guess I should stop here and say, you know, right now we are celebrating Pride Month. Yes. And, you know, so I love that we're getting to talk to you during this period because, you know, we celebrate not only the freedoms that we've been given, but the struggles that we've overcome. You know, there's so much to celebrate in Pride Month. And I think it's so important that we don't forget what it is, the stories of what people have overcome in the past that weren't raised in today's day and age where we have as much social support and freedom that exists. I mean, we've still got a lot of work to do, but you know, when I was that tender age of being a teenager, when you were that tender age, it wasn't the same. So, you know, what was that, you know, in high school, you talk about being a big guy and what people expected versus what they got. Can you go a little bit into that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always had football coaches trying to recruit me and, you know, I'm wanting to be on the dance team, you know, so there was kind of like, you know, it was weird in the sense that I was this big sort of, you know, giant guy. But I just had this softness about me. I hadn't fully come into my own assertiveness yet. I was, you know, very sort of, you know, shy. When I was little, I would go over to a babysitter's house, or I would stay with a relative, and they were like, we were like, you were so quiet. Like, you didn't say a word. You just sat and read, or whatever. And I was really that way, until, like my college years. I was just very sort of introverted and, you know, didn't want to, make waves with anybody. And so there were constantly people trying to fight me in school because I was the big guy, you know, and they were like, hey, you know, they can take me down. There's a psychology to it that I read about, but I can't remember it right now. But they, you know, they wanted that. I am trying so desperately because my saving grace through all of my childhood, everything that carried me through was my faith. Like I was told at a young age, Jesus loves you and Jesus will protect you. And so
were you raised in the church?
Not by my parents, but my grandparents would take me nearly every Sunday. Like, you know, they would find a way to get me to church. I would ride with my aunt to church. And I loved church. Like I want to, you know, you see kids that are like, I don't want, you know, when I was a kid, like I wanted to go every time the door was open. Cause you know, I felt like, oh, this is cool. This is safe place. And, you know, I was kind of a nerd.
You felt loved.
Yeah. And I loved learning about, I was questioning, like, what is the universe? What is God? And so I loved learning what other people thought about it. And, you know, it was at that point where I was kind of discovering things about my sexuality. I was also hearing things from the church and sermons about how homosexuality was wrong or an abomination, or some of the misguided theology that's sort of commonly touted in the church. And so there was this feeling that God loved me, but there was also this sort of self-hatred of this attraction that I couldn't get rid of. So all of that was happening simultaneously, and I couldn't reconcile the two. I couldn't believe for myself that God loved me for all of who I was, because of that. And, I was bullied in high school. There was, you know, I was taunted a lot. And so high school wasn't a great time for me at all. There were so many changes. My grades started to slip. And it was just a really, really difficult time. So when I look now and I see like these kids that live in rural areas, that's why it's so important that you and I talk about it, because without us talking about it, like, our community suffers. Are those kids suffer if they don't know that there's a whole world out there that loves them and that will celebrate them for who they are?
Well, and you know, it's not just the rural communities. Like, I grew up in Brentwood, Tennessee, surrounded by nothing against conservatives. I'm just saying that I was surrounded by, at the time, a bunch of conservatives that didn't believe any way other than, you know, against homosexuality. And I was shielded and protected, never exposed to a gay person my whole life. I mean, and for those of you listening or watching, Brentwood is 10 miles outside of the heart of Nashville. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about the country. This can happen anywhere, you know. And you know, all I can say is thank God for the advent of technology and, you know, podcasts and things, you know, where we have an opportunity to spread love and stories of hope, that if you feel the same way that Brian and I do, you know, that there is, you know, you may be told one thing about all of this, but there is hope, and you're going to hear more of that. Oh my gosh, are you going to hear more of that? So high school was hard for you. It was really rough, and then it didn't really get easier, because leading up, you had some tragedy strike right around the corner.
Yeah, I knew that I wanted to get out, because I was in high school in a small town, and I wanted I wanted a stable family. And this is so crazy, but kind of knowing in the back of my mind that I was gay, I oddly, you know, to please God or for whatever reason, I just wanted to be a father and a husband, and to get out of that, you know, small town. But
so it's interesting that you say that, and I have a follow-up question before we move on. You say to please God. When your interpretation of what pleasing God meant, and you developed that, where did you develop that interpretation of what how you were going to please God?
Well,
do you know what I'm saying?
Because of how we grew up and the negative theology that is not even in the Bible most of the time. And, you know, even, and I don't want to get into like a spiritual debate with anybody who's watching this, right. But I will say that the first time that the word homosexual even appeared in the Bible was in 1946, and there was an evangelical political agenda. And they combined two words, you know, that were meant to be pedophilia, sexual deviancy, rape, and pinned it on us. So we grew up thinking that this was how God felt about those feelings that we had, that this was how that you couldn't please God and live a homosexual lifestyle. Like that was what was sort of drilled into me, that you could not be acceptable to God and do that. Never mind that, you know, there's church leaders that are, you know, committing adultery and, you know, sex before marriage and all kinds of other different quote unquote sins. But, you know, you just couldn't, you dabble in that, then you got problems. You're hellbound, you know, and it's
for some reason it's weighted so differently than all of the other.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a little, when you're there and you're a kid, you accept that because you don't know anything else. You don't know, and you don't realize how ridiculous an idea it is that an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving God would create something to punish it, and how absolutely preposterous that idea is.
That
you would have these feelings and somehow become an enemy of God because of something that God created you to be. It's absolutely ludicrous. And I'm sorry for your show, you know, if people get upset with that. I'm just expressing my truth.
Sure. And that's, you know what, this show is all about talking to people about their truths and their story. And that's what we're doing. I don't think there's any need to apologize whatsoever. You know, and this is all about your journey. Right. And I just so happen to share a lot of similarities as well. And so, you know, I ask you that question because, again, it mirrors so much of mine. You know, what self-actualization looked like for me meant getting married and having children, being a successful man in life. That's what that looked like. And having a good job, of course, right? Like those three things: wife, good job, children. That was that was how I could make my parents proud and glorify God. I mean,
same.
Would you say the same?
Yeah. And for me, it was a way to correct me.
All the things that you felt like were wrong with you.
And the things that I wanted that I couldn't have.
Yeah.
So.
So what happened next?
So I graduate and I start college and I wanted to be a missionary. I wanted to study religions of the world. I wanted to study. I even looked into studying paranormal psychology so that I could understand miracles more. Because I had seen some of them. I went on a couple of mission trips to Honduras and El Salvador and worked a medical triage there, saw people who came in limping that were better, you know, after prayer. And so it intrigued me. I was like, how does that happen? You know? And so in doing that, I went to a Christian college in Memphis, Crichton, and that's where I met my ex-wife, that's where we met. We became friends there. She was editor at a local community newspaper. And so I took a job as a photographer, going out and covering things. And it was kind of when my career in journalism started too, because there was nobody that was covering the local NAACP meetings. And I would often get sent on stories that are comparable to like a cat in a tree, but I wanted to cover the civil injustice stories and what was happening with that. And so it was kind of in a well-to-do neighborhood, Collierville, that's kind of outside of Memphis. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of talk of, you know, what was happening with minority groups in that town. What was going on with, you know, people who were discriminated against? And I'm not saying that Collierville is any better or any worse than any other city. I'm just saying that it wasn't getting covered a lot. And so I wanted to report on that. And while I was there, I was, you know, we were friends, and I had, I started talking to her about, you know, my sexuality, and we were kind of just like besties. You know, we would go to the mall and check out guys together, you know, and, mm-hmm. and all of that. And then as we were,
So for it, if I could pause you here,
yeah.
For anybody who doesn't maybe understand from this background, there's this whole movement for those of us who were raised in super conservative Christian churches and households where, you know, they would identify what we have as same-sex attraction, but in order to live out holiness, you know, we keep that at bay, if you will, right? And you know, pursue either staying celibate or, you know, forcing ourselves to, you know, enter into a relationship with a female and letting God do his work. So that just, I feel like you and I know what each other's talking about right now,
right.
But I just wanted to interject, right? Like that there's this, I mean, this real, very real reality that goes on in so many sects of the world, of this country, of faith, where people are taught to, I mean, this is the way you glorify God. And this is the way, if you have same-sex attraction, this is the way you must function. And so you're in this space where, you know, you're trying to make do, right? And you found a friend that you can share that secret with.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were, you know, if we had stayed friends, we would have been great together, you know? But, you know, and I thought at this point, just let me just set the scene for those who are younger. At this point, the idea of marrying a man and having a family with a man does not exist. Like the idea of having a family with someone of the same sex was not an option back then.
And it didn't look like there was a light at the end of the, like that was not coming either.
This was like, you know, late 90s, and you knew that people were fighting for it, but you thought there's no way. And then you kind of saw in the South, especially, you kind of looked at people who were out as these sort of sad, you know, people who could never find true happiness because they were living outside of God's will.
Yeah.
You know, and you didn't have a lot of examples of really happy LGBTQ people who were living their life and thriving. So, you know, you had them, you just didn't hear about them. Sure. And so we kind of developed a relationship, and we, you know, started dating, and I was like, you know what? This is the person who I love. I love this woman. She wasn't a beard, or, you know, as people said, for those who don't know, a beard is when a gay guy dates a woman to give the appearance that he's straight. That's not what this was. and for those who, a lot of gold, my friends who are quote unquote gold star gays don't like understand that. And just so people understand that, gold star gays are gay guys who have never been with someone of the opposite sex. They've only, you know, been intimate with other men. And so they're like, well, I don't understand that. Well, maybe you're bisexual. And I'm like, I don't know. You know, I loved her. I've never had a problem, you know, being intimate with someone who I loved and who I cared about, you know, someone who was, you know, that I was dating. And so we ended up, you know, getting married. And a lot of it, some of it was because I genuinely loved her. I did. And then some of it was because I didn't see any other option. I didn't know that I could be gay and happy.
It was your path to self-actualization.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, I didn't have a problem, you know, staying faithful to her. That wasn't an issue. I didn't want to have sex with anybody else. I enjoyed, you know, sex with my wife. It wasn't a thing. And I say that, but probably underneath there was a thing, you know, like you settle things on the surface and you go about your business. But what people don't realize is that the cries and the muffles that you don't attend to eventually scream.
Yes.
So that little voice that's down there, if you don't listen to it, it's going to come out some way. I promise you. And that's with anything, you know, addiction, mental health. I underwent conversion therapy. We decided that it was a good idea that I undergo conversion therapy. And for those who don't know what conversion therapy is, it is a type of therapy that teaches you that homosexuality is a disease or a mental disorder, and that there are things that you can do to curb that disease and to stay and to be straight. It has, anecdotally, in the people that I know that have been through it, it has an 80% attempted suicide rate. It's very rare that I talk to somebody else who has been through it that has not had some sort of suicide attempt.
80%.
It's, you know, it has maybe 10% of the people who go through it say that it worked, that they're married to a straight person, that they don't have any issues with that. For me, I was outpatient. They had an inpatient facility in Nashville. I mean, Memphis, sorry, an inpatient facility in Memphis. And their idea was to expose gay people to other gay people that they might be attracted to sort of test them. So you had all of these gay people rooming together to become straight. And you never knew if, say, something happened and you guys got caught in the moment or something, you didn't know whether you could trust that person or if that person was going to report you.
Because it was, yeah.
Because the whole goal was to, you know, be straight. So I knew a lot of the people who lived in the houses from going to school there. And so I started to undergo therapy, and then I was told in therapy, it's sort of, I say therapy, this is pseudo counseling. This is not approved by the American Psychiatric Association. It's in fact very dangerous type of counseling.
And outlawed in
several countries.
How many states?
Not outlawed in the United States. It is outlawed in many states. It is not outlawed in Tennessee.
Right. There's a number of states that I don't even know if it's quite half of our states in the country yet, but it's increasing more and more because there's a shared sentiment among legislators, you know, that this is, the statistics are staggering, just like you said, 80% suicide rate, attempted suicide rate, that blows my mind and should blow the mind of anyone hearing that.
And that's anecdotal. That is, I don't have a confirmed study of that. That is in like around every 10 people that I meet that have been through the therapy, 8 of them will tell you they had an attempted suicide. And so going through that, they teach you that it's all environment, that there's no way that you were created that way, that you couldn't have been created to be gay. And it's because of trauma from your childhood. And, you know, I had repeated sexually inappropriate things done to me as a child. Not, you know, I don't want to be a trigger for anybody, but there were things that happened to me that shouldn't have. And there was, you know, there was another instance, and they were like, well, it was because you were assaulted. And there was another instance where I was kind of an older kid, and I was like 8 or 9, too. And there was this, an older teenager who was, you know, almost an adult. And we were friends in the neighborhood, and he took me back behind the shed. I didn't think anything of it because I got away and nothing happened. Like, it was just like, you know, he was trying to mess me. I was like, what do you think you're doing? You know? And I know that there are people who couldn't, you know, do that. And I want you to know that you were just as brave if you couldn't get away. And that you are just as strong, as I was. I happened to be in a good situation where I could, you know, leave that situation. But I don't want anybody to think that it's a reflection on them if they couldn't. And then there was the stuff that happened when I was a kid, when I was little. And they tell you that that is the root of why you're gay. That is the root of why you have these feelings. And their theory was that you typically don't have a great relationship with your father if you're gay and you're seeking out the love of a man. You're seeking to make you whole. And I felt like the situation with me was resolved as best as it could be in my mind. And I was like, I don't know that that's it. Like I don't know. That doesn't sound right. That this made me gay. Because it happened so organically. You know, I would be looking at, if you're looking at a picture of, let's say, when The Wedding Planner came out with Jennifer Lopez and Matthew McConaughey, and your eyes very naturally gravitate to Matthew, and your friend who's straight's eyes naturally gravitate to J-Lo. But let's be honest, I mean, J-Lo is fabulous all the way around, but but you notice those things. And you think that's not because of that. And so you have like accountability partners where you're like, hey, you know, I thought about a guy today, or I I felt the way that I shouldn't have about this guy. I thought he was really cute. And those are very naturally, like, what's wrong with thinking a man is attractive, even if you're straight? You know?
Right.
Straight women all the time will come to you and say, I think that lady is so beautiful. You know, but if a guy does it, then it's just weird. You know, it's so
right.
crazy the way we're set up.
It is.
So, yeah, you would have accountability partners, and I suppressed that. I suppressed that part of myself. I was like, that is not who I am. I'm a loving husband, and I'm going to be a loving father. And after our marriage, my ex-wife got sick. She had a blood clot in her lung, and she was prescribed opioids for that. My mom at this point had fallen deeper into a depression. She had gotten addicted to opioids. And so at that point I had like both my mom and my wife who had been addicted to opioids. And my mom had started going to dialysis because she was having kidney failure. We didn't know until it was too bad. We didn't know until she was practically in renal failure that she had been on dialysis and had kidney issues. And my mom died. And I think that was a big turning point for me because that was someone that I could lean on.
Yeah.
With everything that was going on with my ex-wife being addicted, you know, it was prescription and she would find ways to get them from the doctor. And, you know, I remember just her trying so hard to get off of them. And you know, just sweating, laying in the bed, sweating.
And this was the period of time when, if anybody's seen Dope Sick, right? Like this was when opiates were getting, like, we didn't know all the stuff we know about opiates now.
Right.
This was the time that it was getting pushed. People were getting lied to. Doctors were getting lied to. Oh, if it's not working, give them a higher, they have breakthrough pain, give them a higher dose, you know. This was that period of time where people who now know, you know, our safety mechanisms, who now know and catch these things, they didn't know then what we know now.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so fast forward, you know, my mom dies. I don't see any hope left. My mom has prescription meds that are left over. I down them in an attempt to take my life. Because I don't see any other way out. I'm not the picture perfect life that I'd always wanted to create. And so I down those. I go into intensive therapy. And realizing that
let me ask you this, because I don't want to skip over
sure.
it. You down it. When you wake up, what happens? What's the thought that runs through your head?
Well, I know in the ambulance I was revived by Narcan. And I was conscious for a second in the ambulance. And the first time I remember like having a conscious thought was when I woke up in the hospital room and I was so angry because I had survived. I was so mad because I was like, you know, and there was even some shaming with that because it was like, you can't even do this right. Like you can't even exit. And so when that was going through my mind, I knew that I didn't have an opportunity to hurt myself in the hospital room.
Right.
And so I was like, yeah, I'll go talk to a therapist. You know, I'll go.
Right. Cause what other option do you have? Right. Right. Yeah.
Right. And it was, yeah, it was, I just didn't see anything better happening. You know, I thought this is it. This is all there is to life. It's not going to get better. And so in going through that therapy, I began to learn a different way of looking at my life. I began to look at more healthy tools to use, healthy coping mechanisms. And it was at that point that I realized that I needed to get that I couldn't salvage my marriage. That we had to part. And you know, at the time, that was not okay with her. But we've since become friends. You know, we're not like besties. We don't talk every day, but you know, she's talked a lot to me. She's talked to me about, you know, regrets and how things work out and all of that. But back then it was just this sort of heated, battle. Like there was land that, family land that I had that was, you know, was disputed. There was just all sorts of, different things. And she said later that, you know, she just didn't want to lose her husband. She didn't want to lose me. And, you know, she said, I didn't realize that I had already that you were becoming a different person. And so, and she's written about that. I think, you know, she's actually written a novel. I don't know where it is in the publishing, but she's, cause one of the reasons why we talked, she sent me some of it and said, hey, I just want you to see this cause I'm writing about you. I don't want it to get published and you be the last person to see it.
Yeah.
And so, after that, I took a job. I was single. I did not understand the gay world at all. I still don't a lot of times. you know, I'm still figuring things out even now. It's a different culture in the sense that when I was before, you know, the whole idea was courtship and, you know, this sort of godly progression to a relationship. And the average gay, there's lots of gay cultures, you know, there's lots of different types of gay people. So I'm not saying everybody, but typically the culture for gay men is not similar to that. It doesn't work like that. You know, it's not like, you know, check this box, yes or no, let's hold hands, let's date a little while, you know, and progress into something, which was devastating for my now idea that, you know, I could be a husband and father again, you know. So
yeah,
I'm learning about that. And I took a job. I had wrote this column for the newspaper when I worked with my ex-wife. And I remember when several people, I wrote an obituary and several people lined up to come and thank me. And then it was a pastor that died there. And then they hung it up in the church, in the lobby. And it touched so many people that I was able to capture his life. That's what clicked in my head. This is what I want to do for a living. I want to help people see things in a different light that maybe they didn't see. And so I continued in my career in journalism, and I took a job as head of security because I had worked some at the police department, you know, before that as a liaison between the TBI and the police department. And I took a job as head of security at Fox 13 in Memphis. And some of the people that were there knew that I was a writer. And so I would start sitting in on editorial meetings and talking with some of the producers. And I would sometimes give them numbers. Hey, if you're looking to find so-and-so, here's their number. I've interviewed them before. As a result, I got a job as an overnight news assignment editor for the morning show. And so the news assignment editor basically like looks at everything that's going on, decides what to send a crew on and when, like, what is the, you know, the TV crew. So, I kind of progressed in that, became an associate producer, field producer. And then, I was brought here to Nashville. I was a producer, assistant producer, to a woman who's now become one of my best friends, who I love, love, love so much. And there's two favorite parts of my night. And that is when my brother calls and when Sarah calls. And when Sarah calls, we do a Mad Lib. It's funny. It's just this sort of thing to like, let's release the day. And my brother calls to get me to explain to him what's going on in the news. Cause he's like, I don't get this. So I developed this, these friendships. I work hard on the morning show. I'm booking, you know, celebrity guests for the morning show. And, we eventually win, the Emmy for Best Morning Show. And that was a highlight in my career. And we began to do a lot of stories on the opioid epidemic, and it had touched me so personally. And I had, again, a best friend, Amy, who was a comedian, and she overdosed on heroin. And when she got help and was coming back, I was like, this is like affecting everybody around me. I can't put my journalism hat on and separate myself from it anymore. I have to be involved in it. Mm-hmm. And so I left to become a recovery advocate and really worked really hard with lawmakers on like the CARES Act, on, you know, with CADCA, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, FedUp, Addiction Policy Forum, all of these organizations that were making a difference and that were changing policy. I met with Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Edward Markey, because, you know, Massachusetts had such a problem, Senator Rob Portman in Ohio. And we, you know, I wanted to be a part of change. I wanted to affect change in the recovery community because I knew what it was like to be treated like I was nothing and that I was dirty because of pain that I was experiencing. And people who are in recovery, it's the only disease that you can get fired for having. It's the only disease that you can be ostracized from your family for having. You know, you go to your family and you tell them that you have cancer. They rally around you. They throw GoFundMes. They have barbecues. And you go to them and you say, I can't stop using. And it's somehow, you know, this horrible thing that you're doing that you're choosing to do. Nobody wakes up and chooses to be addicted to anything.
It's the element of choice.
Yeah.
Our society has just taught us time over and over again that it's all about choice. And, you know, and there, you know, it, it's, it's we're learning more and more. You know, the disease itself is not a choice. It's not.
No. And even the American Medical Association has classified it as a disease. So we have to get to a place where we're treating this clinically and not as a moral failing. And that's one of the things that I was trying to do with that. And I met so many wonderful people in the recovery community, and you're one of them. And there have been times, like even recently, I lost my best friend in 2020, and I just could not. That changes who you are. You can lose your parents, your grandparents, you know, other family members. But when you lose your best friend and your best friend dies, it changes you as a person. You're not the same person. And when that happened, I just had a breakdown. You know, and here I am, this mental health and recovery advocate who is, you know, quite often times when I'm asked to talk about it in the news, it's for a cause. It's not personally. So I say, this is not about me. I wipe the tears away and I get on camera and I talk about it. But there have been times where I have, you know, given, you know, mental health recovery advice to people that I knew, that I've helped people get into treatment, that, that I've talked to and been on the phone with when I was dying inside. And honest to God, is the only thing that saved me.
Was helping another individual.
If I had not had advocacy, I would not be here.
Speaking of advocacy, I don't want to glaze over the, honestly, what brought you and I together was your years of, you spent, you know, doing stories in the news, making the epidemic visible. I know at least here in the state of Tennessee, you know, you were involved with every story that we saw, you know, regarding the overdose, opioids, you know, the drug spike. You know, it was something that we didn't really see. How do I put this? Before, if it was on the news, it was a glazed over, you know, statistic that somebody was just talking about of, you know, a death rate or something like that. You went on, and I can't remember, I want to say it was over 1,300 stories you did. Is that right?
2,000.
Okay. I'm sorry to under.
Why? How would you know?
Yeah. But yeah, so 2,000 stories painting the picture of what is going on, what is really going on in our world, and not just the news blurb of, you know, this is how many people died and then move on.
And, or a mugshot.
Or a mugshot. We know that without advocacy and visibility, things don't change. Dollars don't get allocated where they need to go to promote change. Family members don't get their perspectives shifted, you know? And so I just think it's worthwhile mentioning that, you know, we'll never know how many people's lives you positively affected through all of those stories that you did. So I thank you for that. And, you know, I think it's just one of the most meaningful things. And, you know, I know that I'm excited to see what else happens in your career in the future. the big stuff that you're doing to change people's lives, because I know it's just gonna continue to be amazing.
I have to tell you, Patrick, like, your friendship means so much to me, and has ever since I've known you. When we met at getting ready for an Overdose Awareness Day event, and you were putting up the wall of remembrance, and I was helping with that. And there have been times where, you know, just a call or a text from you have really just, made the difference, made me want to get up out of bed, made me want to tackle the day and tackle things. I went through a really rough time. I mean, I wouldn't take on, clients, just because I only took on like the minimum possible, so that I could survive. Because I had thrown everything in a box. I had thrown Thomas, my best friend, in a box. I wasn't dealing with it. And, you know, I would sit, you know, sometimes in the tub, and sometimes it would make me feel better, because I've always had a thing about water. I've always felt safe with water. I love water. I my baptism, the ocean, everything about it.
Yeah.
And so I would sit in the tub, and I'd do this thing where I would see, how long can I hold my breath underwater? Because when I'm underwater, all of the things that are going on, all of the things that I have to think about, like, if I just hold my breath, like, it kind of goes away. And I remember I was like, I don't want to deal with this day. I don't want anything to do with it. And you called me one time. you were calling me back because of something that we had to talk about. And you just have this way of being easy to talk to and helping people sort of snap out of their spirals. You really have a way of doing that. And I'm so thankful for you.
That means so much. That means so much to me. Thank you for sharing that.
You mean a lot to me. You mean a lot to a lot of people. Keep sharing the stories. People have to see those stories. People have to see what's happening. And that's what happened in the news. You know, I knew that I had to do something to make people realize that these people weren't over there or part of a different country or a different neighborhood, that there were people who lived right next door to them. And so that's one of the reasons why I worked so hard to get their stories on air, because it had to be seen. And us talking like this, I hope that if you're a kid in the middle of the country somewhere, that you know that there's a whole community that loves you, that embraces you for who you are. Stay strong, and we're praying for you. And if you're somebody who is questioning themselves, I will say that the quickest way to break your own heart and to cause problems with your life is to paddle against the current of the universe. If you would just stop and flow with it, no matter how scary whatever it is that you're going towards, if you would just ride with the universe and stop trying to change its course, there are good things waiting for you. My whole life I would have missed out on, you know, if I hadn't survived.
Right. And all the lives that you have changed and are going to change in the future. I wanted to ask you, how today are you taking care of and loving yourself as a gay man and for, you know, from the mental health side of things and dealing with your trauma and, you know, all of that?
That's tough. But
curveball.
I think one of the things that have helped for me is routine. Routine has been so helpful, like, you know, making sure that things are in their place and that I wake up and go through different things and have a process for the day has really helped sort of calm the anxiety. If I can control the things that I can control, I won't worry so terribly about the things I can't. Eating better has helped me a lot. 'Cause, you know, I don't feel like crap all the time 'cause I'm not eating, you know, McDonald's. Nothing against McDonald's, but I'm not eating like fast food. If you want fast food, McDonald's, you go get you some McDonald's. I'm just saying for me, 'cause I'm a diabetic. Sometimes the things that we eat affect everything. So I've had to be careful about what I eat. You know, making myself a priority and, you know, saying I don't break my neck for things that aren't for me to be nice anymore. You know, it's like I'm in my 40s. And like, I feel like something happens when you turn 40, by the way. I'm just letting you know. When you turn 40, you kind of lose your give a damns. Uh-huh. They just sort of like, because it's like, okay, I've been through this before. I'm not worried about it. But
I think we could all use a little bit of that, though. You know, don't break your neck for things that aren't for you. Things that aren't for you.
Right. And, you know, do things and it's like, well, if I don't do this, then this will happen. Well, okay. You kind of learn radical acceptance. Like, okay, this has happened. Okay. What do we do now?
Right.
You know, and that's the hardest thing to do.
I think something you're talking about too is allowing discomfort to be a teacher, allowing discomfort to come into our lives. 'Cause we're so ingrained to that codependency piece to not allow others. We don't want to allow uncomfortable space in or around us because we interpret it as bad. But sometimes when that change is being pushed in, there's it's a needed change,
right?
Right? Like, you and I have talked a lot about that. And, I love that quote that, and I don't know who said it, but if it doesn't challenge you, it won't change you. And, not saying that we should always seek challenge, but, you know, sitting in our comfort zone never takes us to where our goals are.
No. You gotta just go with where the universe is taking you and accept it. Like, okay, yep. This is what's happening. This is why I feel this way about it. And that's okay too. But I'm gonna go where I'm being called.
That's right. Brian, is there any last word of encouragement that you'd like to give any person that's watching and relating today to your story?
This is mainly for the people who suffer from anxiety and depression and think that what's going on with them is just with them. It's not. You're not alone. There's people who can help you. You know, even if you contact Rooted Recovery Stories, you know, they can help you with whatever you're going through. And I think that the important thing, the most important thing that you can do for the world is to be authentically you. And I want you to know that there's people out there who will love you for the uncomfortable things about you, your faults. And you were made that way for a reason. So.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your friendship and for your time today. I appreciate you so much, Brian. And, you know, we always joke that I have a dog named Sully, and Sully is Brian's nickname. And he likes to say that I named my dog after him. And who knows? We'll never know.
He did. He did.
But, well, listen, thank you so much to everyone tuning in, whether you're live or on replay. We're so glad that you've joined us today. And I will close out now how I always do, reminding each and every one of you that it is never too late to start loving yourself. And you are only one decision away from a completely different life. If you need help, look in the comment section of wherever you're tuning in from. And we've got resources available and waiting for you to connect with.
For more information on today's episode, check out the show notes. Recovery Stories is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted alumni community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help. Whether you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please share with your friends, follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. We are grateful for you and hope that you have been encouraged by today's episode. As always, remember you are only one decision away from a completely different life, and it is never too late to start loving yourself.